got seas going right across my deck here now. I did not three or something right up in his vicinity, but no, I didn't.
All right, so this is Goose 2, Roger. Thanks for that information, sir, and I'll get back to you if we come up with anything. Over.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Taylor, and I'll be one of your hosts today. Before we get started, we would like to shout out a few patrons. We'd like to thank Cass and Thomas for signing up. Hope you guys enjoy that content as much as we enjoy making it. We've got a lot of good stuff going on over there. Thanks for signing up. That done. I'll bring in Tanner. Tanner, how you doing? What you been watching? Anything you want to say about the Patreon stuff?
Sure. I will add in just about the Patreon for March. We just put out a few days ago, literally the last day of March, we put out two bonus episodes. One of those is available for all paid tier patrons. That was an expansion on our Princess Victoria episode. Just gave us a chance to sort of fill in some things that we had to skip over just kind of for time. We weren't able to get into the episode, but we were able to expand a bit more on some of the personal stories that we wanted to include in the telling of the Princess Victoria. And then we also put out a bonus episode for our $5 tier, Second Mates. That was a relatively brief but really interesting overview of the Black Star Line and Marcus Garvey.
That was a fun episode to do. That's probably the most fun I've had in a minute doing an episode.
We had to talk a bit about, you know, the Pan-African movement. We had to talk about some of those sort of anti-imperialist, anti-colonial themes. So it was a really interesting episode. Aside from that, media-wise, I've been watching a lot of baseball. That's back now, I think, since last time we recorded.
I haven't watched a lot of baseball yet, really.
Well, the Brewers are doing pretty well. They're 5-1.
Nice.
They're one loss to the Twins. Yelich has the power back. It seems like that's looking good. Their pitching looks good. Actually, the whole NL Central is starting pretty strong, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking at the standings. I mean, the Cardinals are at the bottom, but
they're in the basement at 4-4. So
yeah.
Basketball, obviously, watched some women's basketball last night, those final four games.
I will say I've watched more women's basketball this year than I've ever watched, and it's been a lot of fun.
It's been really great. And I think also the, you know, whether it's ESPN or just kind of the discourse in general, I think they're doing a really good job of playing up their individual stars and realizing, okay, this is what people want from basketball.
I think that's what me and Darcy were talking about, is this is the most we've watched women's college basketball ever. She played basketball like in high school and stuff. So, but you know, it's not like something we sit around and watch, but there's, I can name so many women's college basketball players right now. And it's kind of cool that they are developing these stars. Like, I want to watch Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese play. Like, I was excited for that game.
Like yesterday, NC State played South Carolina really close until halftime.
Until they put up 30 points.
Which is like as much as you could reasonably ask a team to do against South Carolina. They're pretty unstoppable, I think. But yeah, like I think playing into that star power, and then yeah, like that kind of benefits the women's game as a whole, because if you enjoy watching Camila Cardoso in college, it's like when she goes to the WNBA, that's probably going to draw more attention.
I saw a projection today of like the WNBA draft, and it showed Caitlin Clark going to the Indiana Fever. And I was like, oh, that's only 2 hours away. Like, I'd go watch that. I have never said that about women's basketball before.
So that's been fun. Been doing some reading. I'm still reading that Africa's World War. That's a great read. It's very, very readable for how dense it is.
Nice.
Yeah, that's mostly what I've been up to.
On my side, it is WrestleMania weekend. WrestleMania starts tonight. We are a Cody Rhodes, Seth Rollins podcast. Fuck The Rock, Roman Reigns.
It's a Henry Rollins podcast.
The Rock is old and creepy, and Roman Reigns is just really boring. So I don't know. It just doesn't do it for me.
Now, the first time we tried to record this episode, yes, I didn't really have a lot to say about The Rock. But then I think literally like yesterday or 2 days ago, he came out with his thing about how playing into the cancel culture, you can't say anything anymore. And everything is so divided because of cancel culture.
The Rock has become a heel on WWE, and I think he may be embracing it in real life, too. The other match I'm really looking forward to is Rhea Ripley and Becky Lynch. For those of you who don't know who Rhea Ripley is, just like take a second, Google her, look her up. She will be your favorite female wrestler. I also like Becky Lynch too. So it'll be a fun match. It'll be a good time. Other than that, I started a new book. I finished that Civil War book that I was working through. Really good. Highly recommend it. But I didn't get enough Civil War. So I'm currently reading Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy by Donald L. Miller, which I've actually previously read one of his, Masters of the Air, which is just got turned into the HBO miniseries or Apple Plus, whatever it is.
And now it's Masters of the Mississippi.
Yeah, exactly. I like this because after reading kind of a higher overview of the war in a broader context, it's cool to go to something that's more specific and kind of burrows down in there. He's doing a very good job of focusing on the different commanders and everything. So he kind of fleshes out Grant's personality, Sherman's personality. And it's just very interesting. We were talking about before this, how human that they kind of feel with, you know, breaking down that Sherman had a bit of a mental breakdown in the beginning of the war and dealing with a lot of imposter syndrome and things like that. And you don't hear that when you're learning about this stuff as a kid. So it's very interesting seeing these big figures of history deal with very human things.
Vicksburg is interesting. I remember I read, I forget the titles all run together, but the Jeff Shara Civil War novels. I actually enjoy reading those. He has one about the Siege of Vicksburg. I forget if it's a chain of, I think it's a Chain of Thunder. And those books are interesting because they're novels and they go from a viewpoint perspective from different characters. And one of the characters in that is John Pemberton, the commander at the Siege of Vicksburg for the Confederates. And he's really interesting because he's from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I think he married into the Confederacy.
And so he's kind of an interesting figure in the Confederacy in that you do hear, you know, about some generals from the South who just refused to fight against the United States and ended up fighting for the Union. You hear a little bit less about guys from the North who ended up fighting for the Confederacy. Probably conflicting feelings, especially if you're serving under him, of like, can we trust this guy?
Yeah.
This Philadelphian.
Yeah, it's really good. I like the way that Donald Miller writes. He's not afraid to like put it in your face. It definitely skews towards pop history. I would not call it like an academic book necessarily. He has cited Shelby Foote once already. That stood out to me.
Well, you see, in the war, Northern aggression.
But it's a good book, and I do like the way that he writes it. It's very engaging. I know Masters of the Air, there were parts of that I was like, I've never felt so much emotion in like a pure history book before. So it's good. It's very good. I would definitely recommend picking up some of his work. So now that Civil War Corner is over, let's talk about a shipwreck of sorts. Today, we're going to talk about the True North 2. Do you have any familiarity with this shipwreck before the other day when we tried
to record this? We already tried to record this, but no, just about the 15 minutes we got into the episode is all I know about the True North 2.
All right, well, let's get into it. The True North 2 was built in 1948 by Russell Brothers Incorporated in Owen Sound, Ontario. She's originally built as a fishing vessel. At some point in 1972, the vessel is heavily modified and all of her fishing gear is removed. It is at this point that the vessel's name is changed to the Captain Ahab, because why not? In addition to removing the fishing gear, certain alterations were made that included a plywood superstructure, which was meant to protect passengers from weather, steel bulwarks around the vessel that were meant to kind of increase the lip almost to keep water from splashing up and washing over the deck.
Raising the sides of it, basically.
Essentially, okay. Yeah. Just an attempt to make it more comfortable for passengers. Obviously, a fishing vessel and a passenger vessel are kind of built a little differently. So typically, a passenger vessel is required to have a hull that's subdivided into three watertight bulkheads. This would be to slow any potential flooding. We've talked about these bulkheads a lot. It makes sense, right? You want to be able to localize that flooding if you can. However, the True North is exempt from this regulation. The threshold is 75 gross tons. She's only 5.6 gross tons. This is not a very big ship, boat, really, more than anything. It's small. This is probably one of the smallest we've talked about.
Kind of suffering from the same thing, though, from like the duck boats, where it's just kind of so small, there's not really space to have it really subdivided into these.
Right. There's just less regulation because there just is by the nature of the craft, right? This is a very duck boat-like episode. It appears that she was acquired by True North Charter Service based out of Tobermory, Ontario in 1972. And during this time span, she underwent multiple significant modifications. Your personal favorite, the addition of a glass bottom in 1984.
I don't like that a lot. I do think I would like it more maybe if you were in more of a tropical environment and there was maybe some corals and some fun fish to see.
The water was warm, you know.
Yeah, maybe I could tolerate it more there, but I don't think I would enjoy a glass bottom boat regardless.
Additional modifications included the entry doors on the port and starboard side to make it easier to accommodate passengers in need of assistance. And new engines were installed in 2000, which nearly doubled her output of power. Again, more things that make sense that if you're running it as a tourist attraction, obviously you want to be able to accommodate guests with special needs, that kind of thing. Those all make sense.
How much of the bottom is glass?
That I don't know. I'm not sure.
Is it a window or is it?
I think a significant portion of the bottom is glass. So at the time of her loss, the vessel's dimensions were 10.6 meters long, which is around 35 feet in freedom units, and she had a draft of 1 meter or 3.2 feet. So small, very small. She was powered by a single Cummins six-cylinder marine diesel, which generated around 120 kilowatts of power. From the Marine Investigation Report, she was described as...
The hull below the main deck is a common compartment extending from stem to stern and contains the propeller stern tube gland and main engine, located near amidships, and the rudder trunk gland and steering gear quadrant at the after end, near the transom. A watertight steel trunk, arranged on the center line forward of midships, extends above main deck level and encloses clear plastic panels fitted in the bottom shell plating. The clear panels allow viewing of underwater features such as shipwrecks at Fathom 5 National Marine Park.
The report goes on to describe the safety devices on board the vessel.
An inflatable life raft and two buoyant apparatus are located on top of the superstructure. Two life buoys are stowed inside the viewing well combing. The life jackets are stowed in the upper port side of the main engine wooden casing.
One of my favorite things about this one is we get to say the word buoy a lot in this.
First you say boo, and then you say e. Those are the things that float on the sea.
So, in a first for the Beyond the Breakers podcast, our story does not begin on a boat or a ship or a submarine, but at a school. So,
that doesn't sound great for the episode.
No, so if maybe school kids drowning isn't the thing you want to hear about today, you could skip this one. But yeah, that's what we're doing. So the morning of June 15th, 2000, found 13 students, two teachers, and two parental chaperones departing Bruce Township Central Public School for an overnight camping trip to Flower Pot Island. This is not the first time the school had done this trip. During the previous four trips, the True North had been used to ferry the seventh graders and adults to the Flower Pot Island area. The island is part of the Fathom 5 Marine Park, and it's the only island in the park with public facilities. That's why they targeted this island in, you know, specific.
Have you looked at pictures of Flower Pot Island?
I have. It's awesome. Like, it's really cool. Beautiful. I'd never heard of it prior to this, but it looks absolutely awesome.
The name is from the big, I guess it's rock, sea stacks, the flower pots. They're really cool. I think they look pretty crazy. I mean, there's some crazy geological structures around the Great Lakes. I think more so than people would maybe know.
Particularly the Western Lakes.
If they're not from this area of the country. But these are really cool. I could definitely see why it'd be a cool little day trip destination.
It sounds like this is something that's become a bit of a tradition. So, I mean, this is probably something in seventh grade you look forward to, right? Of getting to go do this thing.
It's cooler than places I can remember going on field trips to.
Kennywood in Pittsburgh. You didn't like that.
I didn't go on that field trip.
I never went either. I didn't get to go.
Because that day, that was near the end of the school year, and Mom knew that I wouldn't want to go because I'm not really amusement park people. And so I'm pretty sure she called me in sick that day. And that's the day that we went to go see Kingdom of Heaven. So,
I mean, I guess she figured you're going to a theme park, so it's not like you're missing out on anything, right?
And I got to see an amazing, excellent movie.
That still holds up pretty well.
I like that movie. I know that movie has its detractors, and for good reason. There's a lot of really dumb stuff in that movie, but I like it.
There's some like good stuff in there, too, though.
There
is. I feel like for when it was made, it's pretty good.
I think that movie was good because it like as a kid being interested in history and the Crusades and knights and things, that movie did at least get me thinking about bigger ideas outside of, oh, this is so cool that they're sword fighting with armor and trebuchets. It did at least have a bigger message that was probably a good message to start internalizing and rolling over as a kid.
So back to our school trip. Once they arrived in Tobermory, Ontario, they boarded the vessel and loaded their gear. They completed this task around 10:30 and departed pretty much immediately. As the crow flies, this is a short trip. It's only 3.6 miles. I don't know how long it takes to actually sail it, as, you know, obviously it might not necessarily be a straight line, but regardless, it's not a very long trip. During the crossing, it's decided between the adult leaders and the True North skipper that he would come back to the island the next morning at 10 a.m. to pick them up after their overnight camp on the island. The group did have a cell phone. However, it was generally turned off as a means to preserve battery. And I think something really important to remember here, this is a 2000 cell phone. This is the year 2000. This is not an iPhone. We got, 7 years before the iPhone's invented. You're also up in not a very, you know, it's pretty remote where you're at. So that cell phone is probably only marginally useful. There were no plans made in the event that the vessel could not make it back at the agreed upon time. By all accounts, the trip to Flower Pot Island was uneventful. I do think it's interesting that they didn't make a backup plan to be like, hey, if the weather's too bad, we'll try at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So the morning of June 16th found the captain of the True North waking up and checking the weather forecast before leaving his home to pick up the school group. The weather forecast was broadcast by Parks Canada Weather and Activities Information, and the forecast indicated winds to the south between 10 and 20 knots, increasing throughout the morning to 15 to 25 knots to the south-southeast. Additionally, there was a small craft warning in effect. He would continue to listen as he drove into work. It's also noted that there was a thunderstorm advisory in effect. So, obviously, like, it sounds like he's aware. I'm sure he's able to look outside and be like, huh, it doesn't look like it's the best conditions. But he's not ignoring it. Like, he is at least trying to gather information to make a decision. I would have to imagine he's pretty comfortable working in this kind of weather. I don't imagine that you last very long as a skipper in this kind of thing if you're not willing to go out when there's a little wind. It is interesting to note that this area between like the open Lake Huron and Georgian Bay, it's actually noted in the Environment Canada publication Wind, Weather, and Waves, a guide to marine weather in the Great Lakes region.
The area of the occurrence as being subject to a buildup of confused seas as a result of refraction.
So, you know, anytime you have two big bodies of water coming together, there's going to be some weird stuff going on. This is noted as a kind of rough area because there are waves going multiple directions. You've got a lot of wind coming through there. It's noted as like, this is a little bit of a tricky place to operate.
Well, and Georgian Bay, I know, has come up at least once before on the episode, and we talked about it a little bit. But for those, if you think about your map of the Great Lakes, Georgian Bay is that big
extra lake
lobe coming off of Lake Huron. It is almost another lake. I mean, if there were more separation, we'd probably just call it another one of the Great Lakes.
Right. Like, it truly could be its own lake.
It has those kind of forces you'd expect from a big open lake. It's not like a small little bay here we're talking about.
Right. So due to the forecast and the prevailing weather conditions, some local tour boat operators canceled their trips that morning. So, you know, I guess if you don't have anything lined up and you're just trying to get, you know, people, the tourist trade or something, it probably makes sense to be like, I'm not doing it today. It's not worth getting out of bed.
if you don't have any school children that you left on an island.
I feel like the captain probably feels a little bit of a duty to actually not leave these kids on the island. So at 9:30, the master of the vessel boards the boat, and I didn't mention this, but he brought his dog along with him.
Oh, no.
The dog makes it.
Oh, okay.
Keep the dog in mind, because I have a theory, like, later on with the dog. I think the dog is an important piece of evidence in this story.
Okay, that was me when I started watching Last Voyage of the Demeter, and I was wrong.
Actually, I guess I'll go ahead and say it now. The fact that he brought his dog seems to indicate that he's not very worried about the weather.
This is true. Yeah.
Like, I don't think if he was truly that concerned, he wouldn't bring his dog.
Probably not.
I wouldn't bring my dogs. He then departed Tobermory and set out for Beachy Cove on Flowerpot Island. He would arrive around 10 a.m. without incident. So far, so good. Not great weather, but he got through it. He indicated that as he approached the island, there were waves around 1 meter high, white caps, and some sea spray kicking up. After docking, but before loading their gear on board, some of the adults in the camping group expressed their concerns about the weather conditions. The skipper assured them that they had nothing to worry about. Additionally, two adult tourists who were not affiliated with the camping group asked if they could catch a ride back to the mainland, although they had taken a different charter company to the island the previous day. The captain did agree to this, and I'm assuming this is probably one of the people, like, they probably took one of those that decided not to run in the weather that day. But I mean, it's kind of cool that the captain is like, yeah, sure, we have space. Come on. Yeah. Get out of here. So the True North did not linger at Flowerpot Island. All 19 passengers were loaded, and the vessel was ready to depart at 10:12 a.m. That makes sense, right? Like, you don't want to linger too long. If the weather is getting bad, you want to get in, get out, and get everybody dry. I'm sure everyone's wet and cold and ready to be done. At this point, the master begins to slowly depart the cove, asking a few people to move forward in order to ensure clearance of a shallow spot near the mouth of the cove. Again, a lot of people, small boat, that makes sense. Like, that doesn't really bother me, that having to move
around. Yeah, having to shift people around on a small
boat. I've had to do that going out on a boat before. Yeah. It's like when you fly in a small airplane and they're like, how much do you weigh? We need to move you. By 10:22, the vessel had cleared the entrance to the cove and made her course towards Tobermory, which was generally a southwestern direction. This meant that the vessel's bow was into the wind and the waves. At this point, the weather continued to deteriorate, with winds increasing to a sustained 30 knots. That's a big wind, sustained, in a little boat.
Mm-hmm.
Passengers on the foredeck became soaked from the heavy seas and sea spray, which kicked up due to wind and wave action, with one adult falling to the deck due to a wave breaking over the bow. It doesn't sound like they were injured in any significant way. I'm sure they're, you know, I've been
a bruise, maybe.
Yeah, like, I've fallen over or been thrown down on a small boat in wind and waves before. Like, it happens, right? And get a little bruise and move on. Quoting from the Marine Investigation Report.
When the passengers on the foredeck entered the superstructure to seek shelter, the master left the wheel to close the door, secured it with its barrel bolt latch, and increased speed to approximately 7 knots.
Continuing from the Marine Investigation Report.
Shortly after the passengers cleared the foredeck, a large wave was shipped over the bow and struck the bridge front door, reaching a height halfway up the front window. About 30 centimeters of water was trapped inside the bulwarks. Another wave was shipped, and the accumulation of water retained on the foredeck reached the height of the bulwark top rail. The vessel became heavier by the bow. The master observed that the ship water was draining slowly through the port and starboard scuppers. He instructed the passengers to move aft to help raise the bow as he maintained his course and speed into the waves.
What you're seeing here is that bulwark is trapping in all this water. It's trapping in water quicker than it's draining the water. And now you have that bow, you know, starting to go down and everything. Like, it's not great.
Yeah, I mean, well, and this is just a smaller scale from, like, the Princess Victoria, where you have the scuppers in place there and they're working, but there's just an overwhelming amount of water coming in.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, this is, it's a mini Edmund Fitzgerald. This is one hold, essentially, one big cargo hold.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, the water's not getting out.
It fills up fast and it doesn't drain.
So at 10:25, sensing that this was not a tenable situation, the master reduced his engines and put the rudder to starboard in order to make his way back to Flower Pot Island. Quickly after making this course change, a wave broke over the bow and stove in the front bridge door along with the window. So now you're beginning to take damage from the waves. You're probably struggling to make any sort of headway at this point. Like, this is not a good situation. The vessel also began to take waves over her port side, resulting in the port side passageway taking on water. This water was held on board by the metal bulwarks on the aft section of the vessel. Point being, it's starting to take water from different places. You've taken it over the bow. You're taking it from the port side. It's not a great situation, and the vessel's riding lower and lower in the water.
At this point, do we know how far offshore they are?
They're not very far. Not far at all. So that water is held on by the metal bulwarks like we talked about. Another problem, though, water retained in the forward section of the vessel flowed aft and down, because that's what water does, through various entry points along the way. Passengers moving aft through the portside passage were alarmed to suddenly find themselves in knee-deep water. As this was happening, the vessel began to heel to port, and more water quickly swamped the deck. What you're seeing is your density or your buoyancy just decreasing. You're getting closer.
If I'm in standing in knee-deep water on a ship that's this small, I assume it's already over, probably.
Yeah, it's not looking good. Not looking good. At 10:26, the vessel would briefly right itself and then quickly sank by the stern. Again, quoting from the investigation report.
From the time the vessel started to ship water, the rapidity of the sinking was such that the master did not have time to give out life jackets or prepare his passengers for abandoning the vessel. Some passengers were swept clear by the water. Others swam to the surface after abandoning the vessel by way of the bridge front doorway or the port, starboard or rear openings in the superstructure.
As the vessel went down, her two buoyancy apparatus located on the top of her superstructure floated free, which is exactly what they're supposed to do. The master of the vessel actually reboarded her and stood on top of the submerged superstructure, and he attempted to release the life raft, which was still attached to its cradle. However, he was not successful in doing that.
So reboarded in the sense that it hasn't sunk entirely, or is it just sitting on the bottom?
Oh, it's not sitting on the bottom. Okay. It's deeper there. It hasn't lost all buoyancy yet, but it's still under. He's standing on top of it trying to get to that life raft. By all accounts, the skipper is doing absolutely everything he can to try to get this safety equipment out. Due to the suddenness of the event, there had been no emergency broadcast made to alert first responders or nearby vessels. Of the 20 people on the vessel, 6 of them, 5 passengers and the master, were able to cling to one of the buoyancy apparatus, and 12 passengers were able to cling to the second.
That's only 18.
That is only 18 people. At 10:45, the pleasure craft Picking Daisies sighted the buoyancy devices, as well as multiple people in the water. Due to the shallow water around the island and the difficult conditions, the pleasure craft did not feel that she could approach and offer assistance. But they did report the incident to the Canadian Coast Guard stationed in Tobermory. I think that's fair. I don't think you can expect an amateur captain to risk vessel in this situation. And it honestly could just make it worse, because
if another boat sinks there, hits a rock or something, and then you've got even more people in the water.
And not only that, you know how hard it is to do these rescues when you're not set up for it. You don't want to accidentally hurt or kill someone in the water by being on top of them in your boat. So I fully understand
that. It's the smartest move.
Let the professionals do it. The survivors were pushed ashore by the 30-knot wind and waves, which were now over 1.5 meters tall. So some pretty significant wave action there, 4.5 feet probably. Both clusters would reach Flower Pot Island, although initially they were separated, so a full head count was not immediately possible. Once the groups were reunited, it quickly became clear that two members of the party were missing, both children. A shoreline search was initiated, however, it did not return any results. Upon reaching the shoreline, one of the children in the first group, along with the master's dog, set out for Flower Pot Island Lighthouse to alert a group of volunteers working for the Friends of Fathom 5 organization. It's just a group that does projects, I think, and works on the island to do upkeep and outreach and that kind of thing. It'll be good to note that the master's dog did, in fact, survive this. He is on the island. Also, like, probably good that the dog got to go with the 12-year-old boy to the lighthouse. Like, I think if I just survived a shipwreck, I would take a dog with me.
A dog, a nice companion.
Yeah. One of the volunteers actually recognized the dog as belonging to the owner of the True North and immediately called the Coast Guard station with his mobile phone. So I think he recognized pretty quick, like, oh, they were supposed to be gone. That dog, he wouldn't have left his dog. Like, something is actually wrong here.
Little kid I don't know. Dog I do know. Something has happened here.
By the time this call's been made, the second set of survivors had washed up on shore. After spending nearly 50 minutes in the water, with many suffering from various degrees of shock and hypothermia.
Is there information given about, like, temperatures? I mean, the Great Lakes are always pretty cold, but
it is, and the answer is cold.
Yeah,
it's cold. I saw it, but I can't remember what it was.
Even though it's June, like, you'd still be
it's still pretty problems. Cold, and the weather conditions aren't great. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a chilly day. Quoting from the investigation again,
at 10:50, the CCG station in Tobermory informed the Rescue Coordination Center in Trenton, Ontario, that the True North 2 had sunk and the local SAR unit, CCG 733, had been dispatched. At 11:04, CCG 733 arrived at Beachy Cove to provide assistance to the survivors. Parks Canada staff also joined the rescuers to provide assistance. The CCG Shark, a small Department of Fisheries and Oceans research vessel, arrived on scene to participate in the search. And at 11:25, the coxswain of the CCG Tobermory became the on-scene commander.
So the location of the vessel was easily determined due to the various debris and oil in the water. It's at this time that it's confirmed that two children are missing. And the scene commander requested additional resources, including an Ontario Provincial Police helicopter to assist in the search. The first truly organized search actually begins at 10:25, and that would go until suspended due to darkness at 10:53 p.m. In total, the area was searched by two Coast Guard cutters, an OPP helicopter, two Parks Canada vessels, and six private vessels. As the search for the two missing students went on, the survivors are carried off the island by two air ambulances, which took them back to Tobermory for medical treatment. So they, you know, that's the other thing, that not only are you looking for these two kids that are missing, you still got like a whole field trip full of kids that need to be cleared medically. You know, it's pretty important that you get them back. On the morning of June 17th, the OPP Underwater Search and Recovery Unit made a dive on the vessel. Unfortunately, pretty quickly, it becomes apparent that the two missing kids are with the vessel at the bottom of the lake near the True North 2. Subsequent investigation by the coroner does confirm that both students died from drowning. And I think that that's easy to be a little cynical about, like, well, of course they died from drowning, but like, that's not necessarily the case in these accidents. You know, there's other things that could, you know, go into that. Obviously, blunt force trauma is an option. You know, if something fell and hit you and incapacitated you, maybe you didn't survive because of that. So I think it is important that the coroner did do this and establish what actually happened. There's just a lot of other things that could be going on. It helps us understand how this accident happened.
But they were outside of the vessel itself, correct?
It makes it sound like they were found near it, but not in it necessarily, which, again, it's the Great Lakes doing its thing, right, with the cold water.
But like that, and that also all contributes to it also, is it does help to know in some of these of, are people even able to get out of the
right
vessel in time before it actually sinks.
So findings and aftermath. Why did this happen? Obviously, anytime something like this happens, especially when it involves kids, like the first question is why? From the Marine Investigation Report, there's actually 7 kind of points that they make, and we'll kind of go through those here. Point number 1, the Master sailed to Flower Pot Island in near gale force winds, while a small craft, wind warning, and thunderstorm advisory were in effect. Obviously, this accident doesn't happen without the weather. And I think what's important to remember with this report in particular, this report isn't necessarily seeking to establish blame anywhere. It's purely trying to talk about why did this happen? Like, what are the events that caused this to happen, regardless of who made a decision or whatnot? Like, what are the events? And obviously, the main event is the weather.
On the return voyage, successive waves stove in the vessel's bridge front door and window, and shipped water rapidly flooded the main deck through the front and port side openings of the superstructure.
Kind of taking it down to the next level there. We know the weather's the cause. Well, what did the weather do? That is probably the point where this becomes fatal, is when that door is stove in. At that point, you probably don't have time to get back to the island. Point number 3, ineffective scuppers and inefficient freeing port area caused the shipped water to be retained on the deck and quickly downflooded the underdeck compartment through non-watertight hatches and deck openings. As a result, the vessel lost reserve buoyancy and sank rapidly by the stern. So, okay, we have bad weather, we have a door stove in, we're taking water. Well, now we can't get rid of the water. Step number 3 in this.
Do you remember or know, was there any more detail when it says ineffective scuppers?
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of some sort of, are they say defective, or are they simply not designed to deal with this much water?
I think the idea being that they're designed to deal with the water that would flow over the deck for a fishing vessel.
Like spray, basically, we're talking about.
Well, spray, but also a lot of times with fishing vessels, there's a lot more openings and the water runs off. But when you've built up the side to keep everybody dry, you're retaining a lot more water than what you naturally would have. So if that scupper can just, I have zero idea about numbers.
Yeah.
But if that scupper is designed to handle 100 gallons in 10 minutes, and you've got 300 gallons sitting on top of it, and you're putting in, like, it just, the math doesn't work. So,
like with Princess Victoria, it's like they did end up redesigning the location and the amount of scuppers on the decks of those ferries. But at the same time, it's like there's no amount of scuppers you can put on a ship like that that will drain the Irish Sea out of your boat. Number 4, modifications to the vessel had compromised its watertight integrity.
So that's more of what we're talking about. Like, you've changed the design and function of this vessel. That comes with some risk if you're not fully modifying it.
It doesn't sound like this was quite to the extent of the Holo Holo.
Same type of idea, though.
But when you... It didn't sound nearly as haphazard, ad hoc, as that was. But yeah, I know also any time that there's something that maybe even doesn't necessarily seem like it would compromise the safety of the vessel, and it very well could.
Mm-hmm. Number 5, the absence of a pre-departure safety briefing, the inconspicuous life jacket sign, and the lack of an emergency equipment plan resulted in the passengers being unaware of the location and use of life-saving appliances on board the vessel. So, I mean, it's like the safety briefing on the airplane that you kind of, you know, like, ignore every time. Like, there's a reason they do it.
This, I think, was what surprised me the most, is that I guess I would have expected, you know, you're in bad weather, you're heading back out into it now fully loaded. I was kind of surprised that life jackets just weren't handed out and put on to begin with.
I was a little surprised by that too, especially knowing you have so many kids. But what if I told you there were only 2 children-sized life jackets on this vessel?
So nobody gets one. Well, yeah, I mean, that would be a problem too, especially if this is something that you are doing on a regular basis with children, where if you don't have there's 2, you said?
Sometimes. Okay. Sometimes there's more.
That's a problem.
It's, I think between 2 and 6, I think, is the number it says somewhere in the report.
Number 6. At the time of the sinking, the master was in sole charge of the vessel with no other crew member available to guide or render assistance to the passengers during and after the abandonment.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that. And I think technically he was supposed to have someone, but he had kind of been like grandfathered through the program or something. Mm-hmm. It definitely sounds like once they got back to looking at this, it was like there should have been someone else there.
Even with the duck boats, like I know at least in the Philadelphia one, there was the captain and there was another like crew member who was sort of in charge of dealing with the passengers.
Number 7. The inflatable life raft stowed on the top of the superstructure was not readily accessible and required human intervention for its deployment. The life raft sank with the vessel because it was neither placed in deep chocks without lashing nor fitted with a hydrostatic release unit.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, this life raft was unlaunchable by the time they needed it.
You would have had to physically take it off because it doesn't have this hydrostatic release.
And that's what he was trying to do when he and the captain reboarded the boat. But by that point, it was already too late to do that. The inquest jury that was held found 61 recommendations. Of those recommendations, they're primarily focused on the following. Beefing up Transport Canada's boat inspection program. Despite a litany of safety problems, including a lack of watertight hatches, the True North had been approved 28 times since 1972 by 8 different Transport Canada inspectors. So basically, enforcing the rules we already have would have probably mitigated or prevented this. And I feel like that's so often with these things. You know, we always hear, there should be a law, that we need more regulation. And we usually find that if we're enforcing what's already there properly, then none of this should be an issue. Another focus is improving training for tour boat skippers. The True North 2 skipper, Hugh Campbell, was grandfathered into his limited ship's master's certificate with no training about the importance of the boat's watertight integrity. Basically, he'd just been doing it a long time. Like it, instead of any of the theory behind this stuff, it was just like, well, he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, on a boat this small, I get it. I understand how this happens, but I do feel like when you're starting to take money to move people places, like there needs to be a higher standard.
Yeah, you kind of open yourself up to more regulation when that
especially happens. If you're going to transport a group full of children.
Yeah.
Another focus is school boards improving the safety on overnight field trips, especially those that involve transportation over water. None of the children were told where the life preservers were stored, and only 2 of the 22 life jackets were child-sized, although there were 13 grade 7 students on board.
This is actually one of the things I was reading. I was trying to find some of the contemporary news coverage mm-hmm. of this event.
There's not much.
Yeah, there really isn't. There was 4 or 5 articles I was able to access relatively easily. One of them from CBC, and this was pretty soon after. This is June 18th, 2000. And this is one of the things that gets most widely kind of misreported, I think, about this story is that, so you've just explained there how there were life jackets, but they were mm-hmm. poorly marked. They were inaccessible, and only 2 of them were child sized. And in a few different things I read, that the initial aftermath got reported as there were no life jackets on board.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, like this situation's not much better, but it's very different than going out on the lake with no life jackets.
And I mean, I guess it's fair to say no life jackets were used.
It's very easy to see how those details get twisted. Like mm-hmm. no life jackets being used is very different from there were no life jackets, regardless of, you know, the outcome of the story.
So ultimately, the sinking of the True North 2 was deemed to be an accident with no criminal charges filed. So I'll give you my opinion after, but how do you feel about that? What are your thoughts there?
I'm surprised, I guess. But at the same time, just thinking about the time, like the 2000, I think today this probably gets more coverage because it, mm-hmm. you know, goes more viral and there's probably more independent coverage of it. I'm kind of surprised there's no criminal charges here.
Right.
Especially given some of the faulty safety issues. with this boat. So I guess I would say, like, if this happened today, I would expect the captain to be charged with something for not having his boat ready with the safety requirements.
And I think that's where it gets weird, because, like, he's also, like, he's been inspected. He's done all the things. Everyone said he's good to go. I don't know that he's actually technically, like, violating a whole lot.
And I think yeah, it does come down to, like, how this is right. Like you said, he was grandfathered in. So you could blame all of this on a lack of enforcement. You know,
I think that's kind of where this lands, is that ultimately, like, the Canadian regulators are looking at it and being like, well, why aren't there more rules here? Like, we shouldn't have got to this point.
Yeah. So it's like, I guess you can't really charge a guy if he's not breaking a rule.
Right.
Even though it seems like he's doing something wrong, but having a bunch of kids on your boat with no or not enough child sized life preservers definitely does seem like one of those things that would get you charged with something.
So. Yeah, I feel like today you're looking at, like, involuntary manslaughter or something. Yeah. Right. Or, like, negligence causing a death or some random charge. I am OK with him not getting criminally charged in this. I don't know what punishment beyond what he probably already feels that's going to
Yeah.
do. It sounds like everything. It'd be different if he abandoned them or something and, like, just said, you're all on your own. Like, it sounds like he tried everything he could reasonably to do.
That gets into the larger debate about, like, the entire carceral system.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a difference. And I would say I would expect him to be charged.
Right.
Should he? I don't know that the viability of sending a guy to prison for 10 years is really helping anything in this situation.
I think my final bit of, like, defense, if I was his lawyer, I'd be, he brought his dog.
Yeah.
I don't think he thought that, like, if he was worried about it, he wouldn't have brought his dog.
This is true.
To him, this was just a normal day.
Yeah. Like most of our stories, I think the problems are higher up than just one person's actions
exactly.
on a trip. Yeah. Like, you can find fault with probably a lot of the stuff here. Today, you'd probably do this very differently if
Absolutely.
You're in his situation. He would, I'm sure, do this differently if he could redo it. But yeah, like, you do have to kind of look at a system that allows this to happen, because people are going to make mistakes. People are going to do, you know, inadvisable things, especially if the system allows them to. It's going to make them a lot more likely.
If you've done all your inspections and you've had all these different people sign off on it, why are you going to question it?
Yeah.
One other thing, obviously, we can't talk about this without talking about the human cost. Ultimately, that is the most important thing here. Tragically, Enrica Forrester and Wade Simmons, both seventh graders, lost their lives in this accident. And that truly is the most important thing here. We were talking about how hard it was to find information for this. It happens in the year 2000. So there is information online, but it's kind of the same information recycled through different news sources. But it's a story worth telling here. Obviously, you hope that some good can come out of something like this. And, you know, making people more aware of these safety regulations and enforcing these safety regulations so this doesn't happen to someone else. Quoting from Wade Simmons' mother, "We plan to follow up and make sure every recommendation this jury made is implemented. We're going to keep in touch with the parties. We'll phone, we'll write. We'll do whatever it takes." And I think that's awesome. And that's what should happen after this. I think that's channeling something horrible for something good, is that, you know, hopefully no other mother has to worry about their child going on a camping trip and something like this happening. So yeah, that is the story of the True North 2. Hopefully we did a little bit to bring a little more visibility to it so that we can avoid something like this in the future. I think that'll do it for today. Do you have any teasers or anything for next week? Or are we being mysterious?
Next week, we're going to a country we haven't visited before on the show, but that country shares a border with a country we have talked about.
Okay.
So think about that for a little bit.
Awesome. Well, I hope everybody has a great week. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And yeah, we'll talk to you guys later.